How are you finding that book? What? It's a very good... Okay. So I'm going to continue from this, from where we last left off, but I want to make a commercial to everyone first to look at the book Looking for God in the Suburbs, The Religion of the American Dream and Its Critics, 1945 to 1965, by James Hudnitz Bumler. It deals with how the changes of suburban religion from post-war pragmatism to end of the 50s theology, and then ultimately, by the beginning of the 60s, everyone and their brother started attacking suburban religion as being shallow. Okay? So we go from opening up from our post-war rah-rah Herman Woke type of... This book's about Christianity, though, but it's really about how everyone moves first to the suburbs, and then everyone starts making theologies of modern Methodism and modern Episcopalianism. And then come 60s through 65, you start having the Tillichs, Niebuhrs, Heschels, or Soloveitchiks coming in and saying this is all empty and all materialistic. And this really covers a lot of the grounds for the theological issues and the religious issues. Okay? James Hunnit Bumler, it's on the syllabus. There is a supplementary article by Nancy Ammerman in a book called Lived Religion in America, where she says as much as this is what everybody's life, don't believe it. Meaning, she points out in that book that for as much as people wanted to be rational and this worldly and suburban in 55, come weekends, come holidays, when their grandparents visited, people did all sorts of superstitions and worship to saints and all sorts of old world customs that were still there. That book deals, for example, with the case that there are many very rational modern Catholics who would go to drink holy water in the Bronx, even if it didn't fit into their worldview. The Jewish example is there are many people Jews who would make pilgrimages to Lower East Side or still be getting bankas or visiting Winkel Rebbes in 1960 as much as it had no longer fit into their worldview. Okay? To continue now with where we left off, which was Yitz Greenberg and the rise of the radical right. Because of the radical right here, Yitz Greenberg had to respond to that article. In May of 66, he responded. And I hear in the next issue of Commentator, which is not out yet, the real issue, there will be a further clarification by Rabbi Greenberg tying into many of the things that I've been saying. So when he responds, he says that, look, the major point that I wanted to make was about the need for dealing with the welfare state, war, materialism, Vietnam. My goal was not all those sideshows that the sensationalists picked up on. I must have to now respond to the sensationalists, and here's what I have to say. First, about the differences between conservative, orthodox, and reform. While I said I was orthodox, and I do affirm strongly Rav Kook's idea that we're all struggling with religion in modern times, I admit that I didn't emphasize my axiological difference from liberal Judaism enough. But I also didn't emphasize enough the need for Musar within our daily lives. Two, about biblical criticism and revelation. He says, I am not a liberal on revelation. But we need an orthodox approach. And it is interesting, the example that he gives as an orthodox approach to revelation is either the literary method, which could be developed further, which became a mainstay of centrism in the last 25 years, actually. So in that, actually, we're following what he said. Or the recent books by Rav Bacharach about how to compare midrashim about various biblical figures, which also had just been published. So he's saying he was not claiming much more. He also claims that, yes, we have to do a Bible in the ancient Near East, but he was thinking about figures like Reb Chaim Heller, which once again gets us back to this religious Zionist vision, and that he really wasn't thinking about academia. He was thinking about it just has to be on the agenda. Now the one that really couldn't be dealt with is the question on sexuality. Okay, remember I told you clearly how he presented his statement. He said people were sensational, took me out of context. It is actually part of a longer essay that he wrote. And he says, of course I meant in a married state, because I wrote this, because this was in a yeshiva college context. Okay? Bear in mind that his original statement included the medieval decided that Pnuyotes don't go to mikveh. So you have a problem as to why bring that in altogether, which he was could not deal with. He talks about how sexuality is always religious, and then for that he quotes Rabbi Belkin, and he quotes Kabbalah. But he once again he reiterates, I'm less concerned with external society, but internal society. Mussar, how do we react to the Holocaust? How do we react to the state of Israel? Yes, the Gedolim responded, hearkening back to our Emanuel Rachman showing how great Rav Moshe was, but it's not enough. Okay? It's just not enough. There are more scholarly articles written by the Puritans in a single year than there are all tshuvot written ever about modernity. And there are issues that need to be addressed. And he ends his article saying, is the glass half empty or half full? Those who say we've made amazing strides in modern orthodoxy see the glass half full. He, Rabbi Yitz Greenberg, says he sees it half empty because the issues are enormous. And he reiterates he never meant any changes about outside the halachic process. That's May 66. June 66, Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein writes a response to Yitz Greenberg that really set lines in the sand that were never bridged. Besides his great opening, it wasn't very cricket of you to have responded to your critiques in April, not leaving me many days to respond. The actual substance of the response was one, we're not differing over content. We're differing over whether one has a Torah halachic Weltanschauung or not. We're differing whether one has a Torah axiology or not. And where you, Rabbi Greenberg, are criticizing behaviorism and criticizing the need to respond, I, on the other hand, will always affirm simple faith and obedience. And it's too much to expect ordinary students to think for themselves. They have to rely on great people. Okay? Now we're going to come back to that when we deal with Reverend Lichtenstein's actual thoughts later on, when we deal with centrism. But it's too much to expect students to deal with modern issues on their own. Let that sink in for a minute. Next point is you have to offer guidance. Yes, 19th century liberals believed that knowledge was about questioning and asking and dialectic back and forth until you come to a true answer. But we, on the other hand, don't think that anymore. We have to think about these issues of halacha and machshava as seriously as medicine with precision. So unlike an intellectual, the 19th century intellectual approach in which you then, or a literature class in which everybody can have their say, and then the truth will emerge from it. Here it's like we don't try everything in medicine, and then afterwards see which one killed the patient and which one helped the patient. If you have a sense of exactness. And we have to make sure that our offering best light and guidance to others should not itself be a form of darkness and darkening their life. I mean, we've got to take paternalistic control right from the start and lead people down a proper path. Then he says, much of your language, Rabbi Greenberg, was explosive, value-laden, messy, missing sources. He also found it overstated. He says he has no idea what a sentence like Orthodox Judaism lets all connection to modern life. Emphasize on the word all. What does that mean, all connection? And then he quotes Bishop Sheen, saying if you marry yourself to one age, you'll find yourself a widower in the next age. No, Rabbi Greenberg, I am not coming at you ad hominem, though you might think I'm coming at you ad hominem. Because a big part of Torah is not what's written in the text, but it's Shimush Talmidei Chachamim. And part of Shimush Talmidei Chachamim is to learn Zehirut, to learn to be careful in one's words. As the Rambam says, one should choose one's words very carefully, and that itself is part of Torah.
Why would he say that? What?
Just in general thing, don't think this is ad hominem, is that if your article was explosive, then you should have chosen your words. Talmidei Chachamim have to choose their words carefully. Next. Yes, I am aware about many of these issues. I am aware about the problems of modernity, autonomy. But as we know in Judaism, you don't die from a question. Meaning no longer is the goal about answers. You don't die from a question. Your attitude and your hashkafa, your worldview, is wrong. It is not focused enough. It is not axiologically committed to Torah first. And Havdalah, separation, is just as important as Kiddush. Meaning, where you, Rabbi Greenberg, want to sanctify the world around us, separation is equally important. And that was Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein's response to Rabbi Yitz Greenberg and the commentator. That did not quiet things down. That was already June 66. October 66, but Shlomo Danziger, who gave shir at Breuer's and had a Breuer's synagogue in Riverdale called Chorev that's not there anymore, wrote an article in Jewish Observer, which was the Agudas magazine, against this approach of orthodoxy and modernity. Now, I must tell you in advance that the people who wrote for Jewish Observer, other than Rav Shlomo Danziger and then we'll see Rav Elias, but many of the others, like Rav Emanuel Feldman or Yaakov Jacobs, are going to then be the editors of Tradition and Jewish Action, respectively, come the 70s and 80s. So know that what was passing for a good of thought in 66 became centrism decades later. I mean, the very same cast of characters even moved over. Now, in this critique of Shlomo Danziger. He lumps together Rav Yitz Greenberg, Rav Eliezer Berkowitz, Professor Michael Wishengrad, the whole Yavne movement. Yeah, I told you about that. That was a group of the college students that wanted to embrace modernity. Such figures like Rabbi Schneer Lyman, Professor David Berger and company. Rabbi Blau, right. And he gets up there, and it's not responding to the article, but it's a straightforward, banging on the table type of article. What happened to Torah Min HaShemayim? Talking about covenant and using words like that as shadowy. Two, we've got to condemn conservative and reform. Three, the problem is not our ghetto mentality, but not enough Torah. And the difference between conservative and orthodox is not whether we have one has a halakhic process and the other one is shaped by the laity, but one of them accepts Har Sinai and one of them is completely false. One cannot compare the Torah in any way to jurisprudence, philosophy, or Supreme Court decisions. And those who now want to cite figures like Jacob Katz, the historian, to show that there's human elements within the halakhic process are wrong. Jacob Katz is not an orthodox position. And that's important to understand. Furthermore, our Gedolim never responded, and they shouldn't respond, to war, poverty, civil rights, welfare. We're not interested in anything outside of halacha. As Rav Hirsch says, Judaism has an internal mission. So there are three paths out there. A path of isolationism, a path which he rejects, a path of integration, like the modern Orthodox, which he says is on the road to assimilation, as opposed to non-integrative adaptation, which he credits as the Aguda's position and Rav Hirsch's position. Okay? Know at this point, Rav Hirsch is being presented almost entirely through Rav Schwab's eyes. Torah is to be unintegrated socially, economic psychology. We do our civic duty, as Hirsch tells us, but without any integration in society. We are to be American Jews, not Jewish Americans. On top of it, Rabbi Greenberg is too close to those who deny revelation. He actually sits on panels with the Reform Rabbi Petachowski. And we know where that leads, and we know where it led Rabbi Louis Jacobs just 3 years earlier in his We Have Reason to Believe. And therefore, we do not want American Orthodoxy going down the same road. And even if we're not going to go down that same road, to respond to the ancient Near East, to respond to biblical criticism, is not the Jewish way of study. It's already an American way of study. Meaning, you know, a traditional Breuer's view 30 years ago, 40 years ago, is you study in the Breuer's base medrash and you can go to Columbia for American history, but never the two should meet. He concludes his argument saying that these modernists are more Barth and Tillich than Rishonim. They know more about Barth and Tillich than Maimonides and Nachmanides. And the future is with B'nai Torah, not with philosophy professors. No, not yet. Rabbi Yitz Greenberg then responds to Shlomo Danziger in December 66. opening up, saying that they, because remember, Rabbi Yitzchak Greenberg was rabbi of the Riverdale Jewish Center, right next to Rav Danziger's Shul Chorev. They knew each other personally. And he opens up with very nice, I daven Yeshua, we get along fine, all that. Yeah. And, I mean, well, that's what's going to be so funny here, is that Rabbi Yitzchak Greenberg developed his philosophy of klal, not in tradition, but through the Jewish Observer. He responds that where you seem to think that everything was given in Har Sinai, and there's no need for any application, no need for any interpretation, and therefore it's not like law or philosophy. I, on the other hand, see all application of eternal principles as a form of interpretation. The word hermeneutics is not on the horizon yet. And there, the debates between the subjective elements in halacha are like the debates between Rav Yisrael Salanter, the Bali Musar, who believed we had subjective elements, and objective figures like Chazonish and Chafetz Chaim that didn't. The Israeli rabbinate under Rav Herzog did a lot of modernizing. Svar is part of halacha. He says, you're going after me on revelation was quite polemical, because you yourself, Rav Danziger, reject Rav Aaron Cutler's position on that all other, you could treat the avot as the Merkava, as divine, as completely divine beings, not subject to any analysis. You yourself mentioned that the ancient Near East and is important in Dibur Torah, B'lashon B'nei Adam. So if it's Dibur Torah, B'lashon B'nei Adam, what does that mean? Let's formulate an orthodox sense of that. Where you, Shlomo Danziger, fear assimilation, I, on the other hand, fear a lack of leadership. Covenant is not a shadowy word, but it's much better for reaching people than the Hebrew Yiddish phrase Torah Min HaShemayim. And then now Yitzchak Greenberg goes on the offensive, and he says, my goal is to do Kiruv Rechokim to Klal Yisrael, while you seem to be trying to do Merachek Rechokim to push them away. I don't like the term modern orthodoxy either, because it implies orthodoxy to modern tastes. But we've got to remember we're not in Eastern Europe anymore, and Eastern Europe is not part all of Judaism. And our success is not going to be by reading Karl Barth or Kierkegaard, but by reading more Rav Yisrael Salant, more Rav Cook, more Rav Soloveitchik, more Rav Herzog, more figures that are responding. Shlomo Danziger, as editor, gets in the last word. We are scared of non-Orthodox corruption. We do not think application needs interpretation. Philosophy, literature, law have no bearing on halacha. We reiterate. Questions of Vietnam and civil rights and welfare are questions of machshava at best, but certainly not halacha. Well, I'm scared that your philosophy will turn into reform and orthodox garb. And if we do need, let's say you're right, Rabbi Greenberg, and we need to respond to these things, then let great ones like David Zvi Hoffman and Rav Chaim Heller do the responding. Let it be individuals. Don't place the burden on your yeshiva college students to deal with the great issues. As Isaac Breuer taught us, God's Torah is not on trial. covenant for many readers does sidestep Torah Min HaShemayim. And finally, Rav Yisrael Salanter and Rav Kook were very strict in halacha, even if they were liberal in Machshava. Okay. Now I'll take a quick question from this dialogue before we get to N.C. Greenberg himself.
Liberal
in Machshava. They were strict in halacha.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Would you say that Robinson is being centrist?
The answer is, in hindsight, you know, he actually didn't go into, at several points in that article written in, like, you know, 7 points. Because in real, the Papika level was like so small to that response, because obviously it was a very long letter. Several points he says, I have to start thinking about these issues and I have to formulate my own response. I have not thought about many of these issues as long as you have. I'm going to start formulating my response. So we're definitely going to start going in a direction, I guess. The answer is no. It's an American question. It's the way you determine, you know, what type of traffic lights the city has. It has nothing to do with your Judaism.
And what about, maybe you'll say this is going too far ahead, but certain public policy or institutes or legal institutes which they have developed?
That's going to be part of a real change about the engaged yeshiva world. That's exactly one of the big changes. Yes.
How did we go from the point where it was the MLK people arguing that they don't know about the Vietnam War, and the from people arguing that they, you know, they don't know if you can let them say what the Torah is about?
Right. That will be my very thesis of why the engaged yeshiva world is doing so well now, because of that role reversal and what type of answers people really need. You're actually just now generated where we're going, because both sides are going to switch places. Yes? He's going to come back with... And then that he's going to come back later as a major force.
And he didn't
read all that, or... I'm not sure what he means. When Rabbi Lichtenstein is writing essays in the 80s and 90s, this issue has been put to rest. By that point, the world has changed. And yes, then I must go on.
What role... Were there any others besides Lichtenstein who responded to this? Meaning...
Yes, there was a serious... Meaning... This became a real line that, on one hand, you'd fill the commentator issue of letters. Everybody had an opinion. It did, in the end, Rabbi Yitz Grimberg left YU to form Klal. On the other hand, it had other people like Professor Charles Liebman and Professor Blidstein realize they don't have a role at YU.
So it was more like, how they wrote.
Because it meant where which side is, which way the wind is going.
Okay.
No, it means you clearly knew. If you mean, were you here last class?
Yeah.
Because this started with a Charles Liebman essay in '63 about public intellectuals, which a lot of the people who were teaching here, who left a few years afterwards, knew they were no longer welcome. Yes. That's what I want to get to now. Yes.
About
J.K. Can we come back to that with centrism? Because he had yet really to publish anything in English at the point.
I don't know what he was.
Let's come back to that later. Okay. Now, his grammar then proceeded, because of this, to articulate his philosophy in a series of essays. I'm just going to give you an overview of the essays, because they have a very straight point. We have a covenant with God based on love and our own commitment. And he's going to cite the Rav's Lonely Man of Faith as proof. That originally in the biblical era, the world was God to man, and it was miracles. In the rabbinic era, it was a time of diaspora, and we learned we weren't land-centered. But now we've entered the third great age of history, in which it's now man to God. It's based on autonomy. It's based on Jewish self-definition. It's based on God everywhere, both in the land and in the exile. The Holocaust broke the old covenant, and therefore we have a new covenant, man to God. The state of Israel is our need to respond to the new world. God showed himself and spoke in the biblical era. We live in an era of God's silence, so we have to do the talking. And we live in an age of modernity, we have to respond. So what he does is link autonomy, modernity, self-definition, self-affirmation of the covenant, Holocaust being a rupture, God's silence, and the new state of Israel as all equivalent, as being one link to show that we live in a new age. And because of that, he will say how now we have to think in human terms. He has this very famous quote that angers many other students of the Rav, that Rav Soloveitchik did not go far enough in terms of dealing with the problems of modernity. He didn't go far enough with dealing with interfaith issues. And he didn't go far enough dealing with women's issues, because we live in a new age. They're all equivalent for him. We've got to learn to respect the Christian covenant. His reading of Hanukkah is that many Hellenists were on the side of the Maccabees by their own free voluntary decision, because they wanted to be part of Klal Yisrael, and that Hanukkah has changed its meaning from military to spiritual, to freedom to gifts. Now it means plurality. He also talks about Purim, the idea of Kimu v'Kiblu from Rav Soloveitchik, that we now accepted upon ourselves Torah Shebaal Peh, which for Rabbi Greenberg becomes now our sense of autonomy, our free affirming of the covenant. And Purim is a better model for the future than the Exodus. And certainly in our post-Holocaust world, the Book of Esther speaks to us more than the Book of Exodus. In terms of Zionism, we have to have Jewish unity. We all have to support it. Running our own state means we have to psychologically grow up. We have to accept Jewish power and know that Jewish power is ambiguous. There are good points and bad points with it. And we've got to start grappling with the issues. Okay, any quick questions on Yitzchak? Yes. Meaning Christians had a bias?
No, the Jews were saying that they asked the British holiday, what are you doing burning gibbets and telling people
right.
And then, you know, he says there he has a line about, well, in the Shul in Frankfurt and Berlin, I mean, you know, the words took on new meaning.
Right.
Was that like a turning point for
No, because there's still a kibbutz adati movement, and many in the state of Israel were not particularly fans of Purim either. So the question is really, why did America... and Purim was not a big part of modern Orthodoxy, meaning as a kid I remember, since everybody still went, all the parent level still went to work when I was a kid, our Purim Suda was held at the shul after davening at like 7:30 in the morning. Because everyone was still going off to work. When it switched to now the way we have it, that I've never looked into. Okay. Now the critiques of modern Orthodoxy from the Jewish Observer. First of all, the Jewish Observer, which started in 63, 7 years after tradition, kept slugging away, don't belong to the synagogue council, conservative reform and Orthodox can't work together, Orthodox is not a movement. And they talk about how all the Gedolim were against being part of the synagogue council, and they talk about how the RCA is taking it as an affront to the RCA, and they think that these Gedolim are just trying to insult the students of Rav Soloveitchik. And in 66, Rav Belkin was still going to these events. They really then say things like Rabbi Joseph Lichtstein is just untenable, we're not going to even talk about what he says, we're not even going to talk about the things that Rav Belkin says because they're non-respondable, because it doesn't show a fundamental belief in Gedolei Yisrael. There are no three branches. And if this is all about dealing with the secular, then you have enough American Jewish Congress, American Jewish Committee, B'nai B'rith, and other things to deal with secular issues. More substantive are articles like Yosef Elias, who taught at the Breuer School in the Heights, his critique against Rabbi Gilbert Klapperman, who was rabbi in Beth Shalom in Lawrence during this time, and then also was later president of the RCA in the late 70s, early 80s.
Who's this?
Rabbi Gilbert Klapperman.
The critic?
Rabbi Yosef Elias. Okay. Now, Yosef Elias says, I mean, first of all, he worked well with Leo Jung, which is also fascinating. A lot of the Aguda world is still working with Leo Jung as someone they can work with while they're not working with modern Orthodoxy. So Rav Yosef Elias says, we have to understand, Gilbert Klapperman wrote a book, it's really a high school book, 4 volumes, on the history of the people Israel. But it'll show you the difference between what the original purpose of the Jewish history course was in YU or your high schools from what people are seeing. So Rav Yosef Elias says, the point of studying the past is to learn from it, not to understand the past through the present. And he says Rav Kat Klapperman's book is guilty of trying to reread the present on the past. First of all, as Rav Amiel critiqued the Mizrahi movement years ago, Judaism is not about a Jewish people that has Torah, but it's a people of the Torah. There is no peoplehood without Torah. So bear that in mind to start. Critiques. One, Rabbi Klapperman's book was too rational, and he really does away with all miracles, supernatural, prophecy. All of it does not really play a role in his narrative. He explains biblical history as if it's naturalistic. Two, he's too pro this world. He doesn't respect Kabbalists, Messianists, mystics, Perushim. 3, he treats secular Zionists as if they're part of the Jewish tradition. No, he treats Herzl and other... He doesn't go that route. He just says, obviously, how can you praise someone like Herzl? How can you praise these non-from people as being good? Klaverman is not writing theology. He's just saying, look, we've now emerged and look how wonderful Ben-Gurion was. 3, he retrogrades modern Zionism onto Yehuda Halevi and to others, even though Zionism comes from the Haskalah. 5, he makes Torah democratic through all eras, and we know Torah is not democratic. 6, the book is filled with more praise for secular Jews than for Gedolim. He praises Herzl, Ben-Gurion, Mendelssohn, Herman Cohen, the Jewish Publication Society, Kibbutzim. The point is, the Jewish Publication Society should not get mentioned while the publishing of Svarim should not. Next, how could he possibly think that the Hirsch and the Vilna Gaon are pro-secular studies? And once again, that's part of the big modern orthodoxy, retrograding their approach to secular studies back onto Sadia, Bachya, Rambam, Vilna Gaon. So if you're being a historian, you're not being a historian enough. Finally, the grand conclusion of all Jewish history becomes the foundation of, as he says, the triad of Yeshiva University, the leadership of Soloveitchik, and the founding of the RCA, without any mention of Ner Yisrael, Rav Aaron Cutler, Rav Ruderman, or anything else going on in America, as if all roads go from Avraham Avinu to Yeshiva University. The point is clear, but it highlights some of the way modern Orthodox rhetoric works. There's another article by him on reviewing Jewish education, reviewing works by Rav Alvin Schiff and others, and he says there's more mention here about B'nai B'rith youth organization and day schools than there is about anything dealing with yeshivot. What happened to us? You're also more concerned with modern techniques than with producing from Jews. There's also a series of editorials in the volumes that say we have to have a Judaism only by Torah and to be against an Israel that's being run by the Sochnut and taking people away from their religion. As a side point, since I know we have one person here working on Professor Wishengrad, I didn't deal with him and I'm not going to in this class because the Jewish Observer has nothing but ad hominem attacks for him. So that's why I'm not even going there. It's not Bechubad. Since he did not have a pulpit, you know, he became the whipping post whenever they really had to insult somebody. Okay? Questions? Yes.
Did Elias say the same thing that the Schwab would say a few years later, which is that history is only for geeks who want to really are perverts and want to nitpick about what really happened?
I missed that in the Rav Schwab essay. If you mean when Rav Schwab says that the purpose of history was only for role model exemplarity and how to increase our Yirat Shemayim, if that's the essay you're referring to, then the answer is no. Rav Elias is still saying you're not giving an accurate portrait of even what was history. So what happens? I'm going to do this on one foot because I really don't want to get dragged into all the details. But someplace between 1979 and 1984, all the rhetoric of modern orthodoxy disappeared from the official statements of the RCA, YU, the OU. When and how, nobody has studied, but there was clearly a before and after where 76 Rebellias of Berkowitz could still be on the front page of everything. And by 1983, you don't mention the name anymore. What really happens is Rabbi Yitz Greenberg moves off to form Klal, his own organization. Rabbi Eliezer Berkowitz was subject to increasing criticism from Rabbi Gifter at Tells and Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik, representing the new, more halachic approach at Hebrew Theological College. Rabbi Belkin, between 70 and 72, wanted to buy Fairleigh Dickinson campus and to make YU co-ed and more secular. And no, there was a screed against Rabbi Belkin by Rabbi Soloveitchik about changing the nature of the institution. In 74, Rabbi Rachman wanted to institute a Beis Din to Mater Agunas, and that the Rav came out very strongly against it in a very polemical essay on Omachut Shamayim. Finally, Rabbi Rachman was the leading candidate to be president after Rabbi Belkin passed away, and through a series of debates and struggles, President Lamb became president rather than Rachman, so Rachman went off to become president of Bar Ilan. So someplace in the 70s, all of the real figures of modern orthodoxy either left, recoiled, went to Israel, or became much more quiet from that point on. I must point out, before I go on, that even though they no longer were quoted, nobody told all the modern Orthodox congregations in the rest of America about that. There were still Jews in 1995 and 1996, 20 years later, who still thought Judaism was Rav Rachman and Rav Berkowitz. For example, I was on a speaking engagement at one point, I think it was 2002, 3 years ago, and someone raised their hand for the audience. I was giving my Varieties of Orthodoxy speech, and an older person, and I didn't want to shatter their bubble, but they say, I have spent dedicated my whole life to this Orthodox shul and believe the leaders of Orthodoxy are Rachman, Rav Berkowitz, Rav Greenberg. Are you to tell me that would now be considered on the left or a liberal position? Since obviously at that point in his life I wasn't going to get involved, and I deflected the question to someplace else. But it's important to bear in mind that nobody informed most of the congregations of America of that. So when there will then be a return of a lot of this thought, briefly in 95, 96, with the creation of a whole bunch of liberal movements, it's because they were absolutely surprised. They had no idea that anything had changed. Yes?
Was it in New York? Did people realistically know that these people sort of left
Even in New York, I don't want to go place by place, but many congregations, certain types of congregations in New York, certain zip codes, completely still thought this was the mainstream. Okay. And with that, we now turn to Shlomo Riskin, who took over Lincoln Square Synagogue. He was criticized by Trudy Weiss Rosmarin, one of the traditionalists, because this is not how Orthodoxy is. Orthodoxy is high church traditionalism. And what did he do that really changed things? Is he got up there and started doing things like talking about sexuality every Wednesday night. He introduced women's tefillah groups. He increased the role of a bat mitzvah and let the girls speak from the amud. He tried to be very relevant. On the other hand, he had his more conservative side too. He really wanted to get Jews to stop keeping New Year's and secular holidays. He wanted people to switch over their Hebrew names, so Steve Riskin became Shlomo Riskin. He was encouraging the wearing of kippot, which was a new thing. And on times like Simchat Torah, he's the one who got the custom started of dancing on the west side out in the street, and also dancing to the Russian embassies in order to protest the Free Soviet Jewry. I mean, he created the first modern, relevant, joyous congregation. He also founded his own high school, and he made a very important statement that changed day school education, and that he said, if you pay peanuts, you're going to get monkeys. You must pay a decent salary if you're going to get decent day school teachers. That, because before that, most even modern Orthodox day schools would take anybody who was willing to work for almost nothing, any Brooklyn person, and that was a major modernizing change. Yes?
It was conservative,
and he put in the mechitza.
So you're saying he introduced women's tefillah in Jerusalem? What did they have before?
It was old time conservative, meaning women could not even go up on the beam at all. It didn't.
Did he do this as soon as he came in?
No, this is over years.
First he made
the mechitza, then he said it's Orthodox, and then he introduced these things. He emphasizes the importance now of Kiruv. Modern Orthodoxy will take on Kiruv. And in this, Riskin will be exemplify the whole movement of TLS, Torah Leadership Seminars, that produced President Joel and Vice President Hillel Davis and others, that you go out and you reach out to people. And at that point, one of Rabbi Riskin's assistants was now Rabbi Effie Buchwald, who then made it his full-time career. But for Orthodox Jews to take on Kiruv, which is something we learned from Chabad, was something very new. Judaism was no longer limited to geography, meaning, you know, oh, you belong to Long Island Town X, and therefore that's all the synagogue rabbi should care about. No, we do outreach. We need to do tovacha, we've got to reach them. All the non-Orthodox are onus. They didn't want to be that way, and we've got to be inspired by Rav Kook to go out and reach them. We should even see the hippie movement and the drug culture as a chance of reaching alienated Jews. We should look upon the positive aspects of everything. I'll take questions afterwards. In terms of high school, it's got to have more joy, dance, sense of God. We've got to be methodological. And we've got to talk about meaning. It's not enough just to do things by rote or nostalgia. When he writes an article about modern Orthodoxy as a whole, already in 76, he's talking about the shift to the right. Because Lakewood, New Yeshivot, Chabad, break off minyanim, are offering valuable things to people. Let's not forget that. We live in a time where values are being questioned. But what really is the problem that I want to address is the problem that the Jews of our modern Orthodoxy are reverse Maranos. They keep ritual, but they are completely secular inside. They are glatt kosher secularists. And our shuls have no kavana, no kedusha, no emuna. We've got to have more Torah within our lives, more emuna, more kedusha. State of Israel. We've got to realize the State of Israel, as he puts it, is not a big Camp Mossad in the Middle East. Okay? And in this, he's very different than centrism. We have to realize there was a fundamental change to the world, and we've got to respond in realistic terms, which means it's about army, protection, security, building a government. It's not just about going off to summer camp. And finally, we have to have an ethic, we have to present an ethical vision of Judaism to the world. Okay? He was very powerful, and a lot of rabbis, even as they stopped quoting Rav Berkowitz and Rav Rachman, will still be quoting Rav Riskin through the 80s and 90s. Okay? And know there's a very strong relationship between Lincoln Square Synagogue and then the eventual creation of Eidah. Let's go from one extreme to the other, but it's really not, and that's Meir Kahana. Now, I don't want to deal with the history parts, only the Jewish thought parts. There's some good books out there by Friedman and others showing how it started JDL's protection, and then the FBI built him up because they were more worried about the Black Power movement, and then he started going after doing all sorts of demonstrations, even violent ones, to save Soviet Jewry. He would also took over the Jewish press and wrote under 5 to 7 pseudonyms a week. Columns of all different points. And know also he was an incredible Bucky, an incredible Talmud Chacham. That was also part of his attraction. He was an incredible, credible Talmud Chacham. So therefore, you coming from YU with Lumdus, you couldn't argue with him. I have a friend who says he once argued with him by inventing an imaginary Yerushalmi, because other than that, there was no way to ever win with him. And at the same time, he was very media savvy. Meir Kahana's thought will be very important, because what we're going to create is a Rav Soloveitchik Meir Kahana synthesis, a YU Meir Kahana synthesis. I mean, whenever he used to come to campus, you know, he had 600 people attending. And among the important things of what he really changed is he got people now to take Devarim, Deuteronomy, literally. He got people to read the Bible in a literal way, that in some ways, because he was a very big Talmud Chacham, that dovetailed with a lot of what was being said elsewhere. So he says, why be Jewish? The purpose of Judaism is based on our Judaism, our Torah in Israel. Know there's a sharp distinction between Jews and Gentiles, and Judaism and the State of Israel are based on divine decree. War is good. Everywhere I look in Tanakh, I see the importance of war, from Shemot Oh, and everywhere else, wars were good. The Rambam shows you war is good. Hold on. He continuously attacks what he calls Jews for nothing. Jews who live their suburban lives, who belong to Hadassah and Long Island temples, as he puts it, who live without God's decrees, without a sense of Judaism. They are the Hellenists of today. They like the material vomit of Long Island and L.A. They're empty of values. They live for materialism. Okay, so he's thinking of the world. Think of the world of the characters of Philip Roth, Eli the Fanatic. You know, the Long Island resident is the worst in his mind. And he says, I'm going to come in and be the fanatic. He says, revenge is the Jewish way. We've got to take revenge from the Holocaust against Christians, against Afro-Americans, against Arabs. Why else would we say, Shvach HaMascha Ala Goyim? We want that. It is not a chance just to sing about Eliyahu. We want to go after Gentiles. The Jewish state, since it's a divine decree, is only for Jews, as the Bible tells us. Judaism is not democratic. We believe in the transfer of Arabs. Don't worry about what the rest of the world will say. And he's against secular Judaism. Know that in many ways know that even when he moved to Israel, he actually lived in Matnesdorf. I mean, he kept his Haredi credentials throughout. Even as much as he was an incredible influence on the modern world. Some of the articles you may want to look at on the website, on kahana.org/mayor, /mayor, where articles are What Makes Bernie Run? Why Be Jewish? Jews and Judaism. Now, what makes Bernie run? Why are Jews marrying non-Jews? It's because you never taught them Judaism. Your AJCs, your B'nai B'riths, your Long Island congregations were devoid of Judaism. Your bar mitzvahs were sickening, empty, devoid rituals. And in the end, you make people worship before the golden calf and molech of material success, becoming a doctor or a lawyer. And you want to know why people are running from Judaism? How dare you ask that question? You've made Judaism into a joke. And know that out there are debates between Rabbi Yitz Greenberg and Meir Kahana, between Walter Wurzberger and Meir Kahana, between Saul Berman and Meir Kahana. There are on-record debates that all the ethical figures really had to respond to him. But at that point, it was a debate. Is it Meir Kahana, or is it something else? Meaning ethics. We're going to see, and I'm not going to talk about much of this, since when we do centrism is very usually packed itself on the back by saying we reject Meir Kahana and therefore we're ethical. But that doesn't mean they're going back to the ethics of Rabbi Wurzberger, Rabbi Berkowitz. Just so long as you reject Kahana, you're seen as ethical. But in the end, you know, for most Israelis, the most famous YU graduate is Baruch Goldstein. Bear that in mind, that it produced a very funny synthesis about people who are this worldly and modern here, but have a real deep-seated need for revenge and hatred. Yes?
How is it that Kahana sort of metastasized his way into the Haredi world as well, where he engaged Yeshiva Shekhar, so-called, up until Satmar, basically, acceptable to harbor these terrible...
Let's start his history before we get to who he was. Brooklyn Jewry, Queens Jewry, urban ethnic Jewry was still very hurt by the Holocaust. He's the one who got up there and said, never again. Wait. He got up there and it really resonated with people, never again. You know, teach your kids how to fight. Teach your kids how to street fight with nunchucks. For many, it made real sense at the time. People were hurting. Go read Yossi Klein Halevi's Memoirs of a Jewish Extremist. Now he's a peacenik and he believes in interreligious dialogue, but you've got to understand that moment in Brooklyn, that moment in Queens, when our parents were all still scarred and still, you know, had a hatred of the old country. He got up there and said, never again. Two, he never gave up. He always either lived in Brooklyn and then in Mattersdorf. He never gave up his Haredi credentials in such a way that he was really part of the yeshiva world. So as much as you could have been graduating Chaim Berlin and been an anti-Zionist, you still would have gone flocked to hear him in Flatbush about never again. And there was an attraction even for the yeshiva world in those days. Okay, many a biography will talk about the great attraction he had for people in those days. Okay, so what it didn't happen, I think it had to do with the fundamental state of where Judaism was. It was egged on that in between 1967 through 70, there was a series of events that included, one, Queens Jews fighting the building of housing projects in successfully in Hillcrest and unsuccessfully in Forest Hills to keep low-income housing out. It had to do with the teacher strike, in which the tension between Jewish teachers teaching ethnic kids in the city. It had to do with the Harlem and other neighborhoods erupting and Jewish store owners having to flee. Know that my family owned a store on 103rd Street in 67. It was sold that year because after several Jewish stores were burned. So that does play a role into this. And then the pride of the Six-Day War and this image of Jewish military might. Yes?
What is the role that Shlomo plays?
I'm going to get there. Thank you. Yes? He started out with the JDL, we're going to patrol the Brooklyn streets.
And then from that he worked with Russia and then Israel.
No, therefore, I don't want to go into the politics, and that's why, of course, in modern orthodoxy, that depends how you take how much he was then being used by the FBI to fight the Afro-Americans and how much he's being manipulated, but it helped build him up also. Okay? So his followers will deny all these reports. The critics will then say he's creating a Jewish bunch of neo-Nazis and that he's actually a Jewish version of Black Power. You can go read, there's a half a shelf of books on him, and I just said I don't want to go down that route. I just want to deal with the role of his theology, because what this now said is that an NCSY kid, besides quoting Eric Fromm and Eliezer Berkowitz, can now also quote the fact that Long Island temples are empty.
Also, where did he come from as far as throughout education?
Mir in Brooklyn. Yes.
Did he have any non-radical students who were carrying this theology but not in a radical way? Or was it all a new package?
Okay, no, many more. Meaning, I don't know what you want to count, where you want to place. Certainly you'll see the influence of Mark Kahaner on figures like Rav Avi Weiss before he moved away from aspects of this. You'll see elements of this on Shlomo Carlbach before he moved away from elements of it. You'll see elements of Meir Kahana just on a lot of the centrist political rhetoric, the way a lot of centrists read Rav Soloveitchik on politics. That a lot of, you know, where the Rav would get up there and say, I can't deal with political issues, it's in the hands of the generals. And he's on record in that for 67. But the way it gets quoted now in YU, it's as if he was quoting the Rambam directly, the way Meir Kahana was. Okay, so meaning, like I said, most of the people who write on him are either incredibly biased in one direction or the other. Now moving on to Shlomo Carlbach. Now Shlomo Carlbach really got started in the late 50s and had changes through the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s. In the 60s, he was already known as the singing rabbi. There's a Rav Moshe Tshuva that I don't want to discuss dealing with him already from the early 60s. He is one of the founders of Neo-Hasidism and the Hasidic Song Festival, that where we now think Hasidus means singing is a lot due to the Hasidic Song Festival. And he used to play in places like along the funk clubs like the Finjan and the Village Gate. Village Gate is still there. He then moved to San Francisco for the House in Love and Prayer and embraced all his holy hippolach. Then founded Modi'in in Israel, a moshav. Then he really moves back to New York and takes on a whole new life as a storyteller, teacher, inspiration, singer of nigunim to be used in shul. I mean, no longer is it hippolach and nightclubs. It really took on a much greater sense of gravity in the 80s. And what did he teach? In the 60s, his teachings were all really, Lord, get me high. And I gave you some stories about how he could invite 200 people to Saul Berman to just show up at his door. Like, everything was happening in the 60s.
I have teaching with Gemara
Shira. Yeah. Yeah, did I say there wasn't substance? No. But a lot of the songs, the issue was not. But coming back, when he came back in the 80s, it really, the substance changed. He was now reaching out to B'nai Torah. He really took pride in all the yeshiva students who came to him. And it really did change its emphasis. The least aspect and the most well-known is now creating a Nusach HaTfilah that's now used in many places for Kabbalat Shabbat. He was never as strict in it as these shuls have made it, but it was now creating a joyous Nusach HaTfilah that replaced Nusach Ashkenaz in many synagogues throughout Jewry. He also started teaching a doctrine of joy, but it was joy really aimed at a post-Holocaust, post-urban ethnic era. I mean, I remember the first time I heard him teach, and he said, I bet you all your rabbis are very strict about